Welcome to Authors of the Pacific Northwest, where we connect Pacific Northwest authors with new listeners and provide advice for aspiring authors on the business of writing. I'm your host, Vicki J. Carter. So hi there, listeners. Thank you so much for coming back to the podcast. And I have a really awesome author I'm super excited to have on the show today. Her name is Eileen Bjorgman, but I probably said it wrong, so she can correct us. But Eileen, why don't you say hi and give us your last name.
Hi, everybody. This is Eileen. And yes, my last name is pronounced Bjorkman.
It's Bjorkman. Yeah. Awesome. Thank you. My podcast listeners know that I'm going to mess up people's names. That's just kind of the way it goes. So Eileen, tell us a little bit about, first off, about yourself. What state in the Pacific Northwest are you in? And if you have, or if you're currently working, or what did you do, you know, as a, besides being an author, because you have a very interesting story. So,
So I have a house in Everett, Washington, and I consider myself from Washington state, even though I spent most of my life in the military, and I'm actually working back in Virginia right now. Okay. I work at the Pentagon. And so, but I get back to Washington state quite a bit, and I still have my house there and all my family's there and everything. So, so I consider myself a Washingtonian. So.
Well, we'll claim you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I get back there as much as I possibly can. In fact, I'm going to be back there on Wednesday. So yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I try to get back at least once a month. So, and then I'm planning to move back permanently, probably next summer. I'm not on a specific timeline, but plan to get back there for good eventually. So, what I did before. So I just told you I'm still working at the Pentagon. I spent most of my adult life in the military. I did work for 1 year after I graduated from college as a computer programmer there in Seattle. Uh-huh. And then I got a little bored with that. And so I decided to join the Air Force. And I sometimes wonder, gee, maybe I should have hung around and went to work for Microsoft or something. I had such a great experience in the Air Force. I wouldn't trade that for anything. And I lived all over the United States. I was a flight test engineer, so I got to fly in the back seat of various military airplanes and got to see a lot of interesting stuff there. And then after I retired from the Air Force, I went back to work for the government as an Air Force civilian. And it was when I was out at Edwards Air Force Base a few years back that I kind of got the idea to start doing a little bit more writing. And mm-hmm. I'd always done a lot of technical writing, but I wanted to start doing something that was more broad and could help me to reach a broader audience. So,
Well, it's awesome. And I'm so thrilled to have you on the podcast because I love women that have been in roles that traditionally aren't like traditional roles, you know, and you have one of those awesome stories. I'm in IT, and women are now more in IT, but you know, that wasn't the case necessarily. So tell us, when did you realize that you were an author in the sense that, you know, for publication, like what the work you'll share with us, when did you realize that?
That started, like I said, I've always been interested in writing. Actually, I wrote a lot when I was a kid. I never really liked English classes where, you know, we just did grammar and things like that, but I always liked it when we wrote things. And my teachers always encouraged me but I was also good at math and science. So I wound up going into computer science and then aeronautical engineering instead when I went to college actually went to the University of Washington. That's where I got my original undergraduate degree in computer science there. So, like I said, I always did a lot of technical writing, but I'd always kind of had this idea that I wanted to write a book someday. And I kind of assumed it would be a technical book, you know, because But then as I got a little older and I started thinking, you know, I want to do something besides just write technical stuff. So my book, the Propeller Under the Bed, with the title for that actually was something that my mother had come up with. And she had always said, kind of the premise of the book is my dad always wanted to build this. He designed this airplane. He wanted to build it and fly it to set a world record. And he had designed it when he was in college in 1960. And so, you know, here it was 30, 35 years later, and he still hadn't gotten around to building this thing. You know? And my mother started to say, because they had bought a he had bought a propeller for it at some point, and there was no place to store it, so they literally stored it under the bed.
I love it.
So yeah, and so my mother started saying, you know, after about 35 years, if he ever gets around to building that airplane, I'm going to write a book called The Propeller Under the Bed.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But unfortunately, she died before the airplane was finished and before record and everything. But I kept thinking about that, you know, and I actually did write a short magazine article called The Propeller Under the Bed. And, and that got published in a small aviation publication. And I kind of forgot about it. And but then, you know, as I got a little older and started thinking about, you know, retire, you know, that kind of thing. And I thought, you know, I really would like to start writing. And so I asked my dad if he would be interested in, you know, in writing a book and, you know, helping me to write a book. And and he said, sure. And I was kind of surprised because I thought, you know, I thought he might say, no, I don't want my life in a book, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
He was actually very much in favor of doing it. And I think some of that was because he knew that that was kind of one of my mom's ideas. I don't know if she would have ever done it herself. But I think, you know, because it was something connected to my mom. And so first I had to figure out if I could even write a book because I didn't know anything about how you write a book or anything.
Exactly. Yeah, so the technical writing down, great, but the actual storytelling beyond that, right?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And the mechanics. And like I said, I had a lot of technical writing experience, but I didn't really know how to write something entertaining. And, and you know, I really liked authors like Jon Krakauer and, and things like that. So, and I knew that that was kind of the kind of writing that I wanted to do. And so I discovered that that was called creative nonfiction. And I took a couple online courses, and then I wrote a few articles, and I managed to get one accepted by Air and Space Magazine, and things kind of went from there. And so I kind of started establishing, you know, myself as, I wouldn't say, a famous author or anything, but at that point I thought, you know, I think I can do this, you know, because writing a book is really just a whole bunch of articles, right? You know,
Exactly.
Kind of all strung together. And, and again, I took a few more classes and I learned how to write a book proposal. And I also took a certificate program they have at University of Washington in nonfiction writing. So, and that helped a lot too. And as part of that, I actually, you know, worked on a book proposal as well for the book that eventually got accepted. So I, you know, I'd say it was probably about 5 years ago, 5.5 years ago that I started to consider myself an author. You know, that I thought that, you know, I really have what it takes to do this in some small way, you know, I can do this. So, yeah.
That's awesome. And so the whole focus of this podcast and how it got started for me to start interviewing authors, published authors, is because I'm kind of on that journey as well. I won't say I'm an author yet. I'm aspiring. So I'd love to hear how other authors, where they landed on those moments with those pivotal points when they're like, I can do this, because it inspires me and I hope it inspires other listeners. And so you gave us an awesome, I mean, it's a journey, and that's something that I think that I have to often remember. It's not going to happen overnight. It's a journey.
Exactly. Yeah, and there's a lot of detours along the way. So yeah, the book I wound up writing was quite a bit different than the book I originally thought I was going to write. But I think it's a much better book than the book I originally thought I was going to write. So,
that's awesome. Well, we're going to wrap back around and touch on a couple things that you said. The first thing was that the title of the book, why don't you share us with that? Because you already shared it, but I want to make sure the listeners heard what the title was.
It's called The Propeller Under the Bed, and the subtitle is A Personal History of Home-Built Aircraft.
So. I just love the title. It's so fantastic. And then hearing the story, I love the title before I heard the story. So now it even makes a bigger meaning, you know, to know that there's a legacy going on behind this book, which is brilliant, you know. And you touched on the genre too. So tell us what the genre is. For listeners that might not be familiar with this kind of genre, kind of touch base on what that is.
Okay, so it's called creative nonfiction, and a lot of creative nonfiction is memoir, or it's used for you know, just to tell some kind of story. So, you see it in journalism sometimes when you read pieces that are more your kind of human interest kind of pieces. It's the kind of work you see in the New Yorker and Harper's. It's that and Jon Krakauer. You know that. So it's nonfiction, so it's all true, but it's presented in such a way that it reads more like a novel, that it really, you know, to help draw people into the subject matter more. So, and make it more accessible to a wider audience is mostly what you're trying to do. So
I love it. Well, thanks for explaining. We had Peter Gibb on the podcast, and he does memoirs, and he explained a little more about memoir writing for listeners, and I learned a ton from it too. So I love the creative aspect of it, in the sense that, you know, it comes from history, but mm-hmm. it also is telling a story that can be useful or helpful for other people. So
that's fantastic. Mm-hmm.
So I kind of heard a little bit about the publication process for you, and let me guess, but you can correct me. So are you a traditionally published, meaning you are going through a publishing company, you did the Curie letters and you're picked up? Is that how this one is?
Yes. So I did a book proposal. So with nonfiction, typically you do a book proposal. And so I did that. And I tried to get an agent. I started mm-hmm. sending out query letters. I actually went to some conferences too. Mm-hmm. A lot of conferences you go to, they have some of them call it kind of like speed dating, where you can go.
Yeah, I've heard about them. They're scary.
You really have like 5 minutes to sit with an agent and say, mm-hmm. you know, pitch your idea. And then, and about half of the ones I talked to said, yeah, please send me your proposal. You know, it sounds interesting. And, but none of them ever picked it up. Mm-hmm. Some of them I never even heard back from. You know?
Yeah.
So after querying about maybe 30 agents, I was getting a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. tired of trying to find somebody, and, mm-hmm. and I really wanted to do this book first. You know, one of the things I thought was maybe I should try to do another book first, and then mm-hmm. You know, and then write this one second. But my dad's getting older.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a little bit of a timeline.
Exactly. So yeah, if he was, you know, 50 and I was, you know, 30, you know, maybe. But you know, yeah. He just turned 90, and so I didn't want to wait too long. And so I finally decided, you know, I wonder if a smaller press might be interested in it. Mm-hmm. And so, so I did start sending out to some smaller presses as well, you know, some that were kind of aviation related and things like that. I had hoped Smithsonian Press was going to, they expressed some interest originally, and then they kind of backed off. And then I sent it to University of Washington Press, because I'm an alumni.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, why not? You know, maybe
let's try it. There has to be benefits, right, to be an alum.
That's right, yes. Yeah. And so initially the editor, she was really nice. She wrote back and she said, because initially my book was just going to be about my dad and about mm-hmm. the record that he set. And it had a little bit of stuff in there about home-built aircraft, because he wouldn't have been able to, you know, design and build his own airplane if people weren't allowed to do that in the United States. And exactly. So there was a little bit in there about the history and how people came to have that right in the U.S. and kind of what it meant and everything. It was maybe about a chapter's worth of material. Anyway, the editor, she wrote back and she said, I think a book that would work better for the press would be, you know, something that was more history and less about your dad, you know, so maybe about mm-hmm. half. And mm-hmm. and she said, but you know, since you've already, you know, got your proposal written and everything, you know, I probably wouldn't want to do that. And I was like, no, wait a minute, you know, actually, because when I had been doing my research, I had been thinking maybe there's a book about home-built aircraft, you know, the history of home-built aircraft written. Yeah. And I thought, well, why not put the two together? You know, that's really not a bad idea. And so so she allowed me to redo the proposal. And so I went back and did a little bit more research and kind of redid the proposal. And they took it. They accessed it.
Oh, super great.
Yes. Yeah, so it's a small press. I mean, it's a traditional press, but it's a small press. And but a lot of authors actually get started that way. You go through a small press or an academic press, and mm-hmm. and not all academic presses just write academic books either. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of them do have general interest books like mine. They do tend to have a little bit of a kind of a historical or researchy mm-hmm. flavor to them, you know. But mm-hmm. but the academic presses, I think, is a good way to go. So.
And then you get that experience of working with the editor process and, you know, and the cover design and all that
exactly.
that you wouldn't necessarily have experience if you self-publish and then jump into a traditional publishing. You get that experience.
So exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, it was a great, all of that I got to go through. And then, the one thing that caught me a little off guard was I had to prepare an index. Kind of came up at the end, and I was like, index, did I agree to do that? And I had to, you know, go back and I look at my contract and go, it does say an index. I guess I didn't notice that. Oops. Yeah. But that was a learning experience too. And there's actually a book you can buy about how to prepare an index.
Yeah. There's information about every aspect. It's almost overload sometimes, but that's really funny. Read your contracts. Point of the story. That's awesome. So let's talk a little bit about marketing, because what I'm finding with authors, regardless of how they're publishing, self-publishing is obviously individuals know that they're going to have to do some marketing. And but with your experience, did they discuss with you about marketing? Did they have a quota for Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, anything like that? Because I'm curious about that.
So we did talk about marketing, and they did a little bit of marketing for me. They like mailed out the books to, advanced copies to various papers and things like that. And I don't think any of them ever, I don't think I ever got a review, not that I know about.
And reviews are the lifeblood for authors. So listeners, if you hear anything.
That was a little bit frustrating. I did finally get one review. It was actually a guy I know.
Yeah.
And I don't know him well, but it was a guy that I know, and he wanted to review the book because he's been trying to kind of get into writing himself.
Yeah.
But he actually did do a review in an aviation, related publication. And, and that was really nice. But most of the marketing really has been for me. I mean, they have helped a little bit with, they were able to kind of place some pictures in like the UW alumni magazine, but they haven't really done any real advertising or anything. Pretty much everything has still been on me to do most of my marketing. So I've set up, book signings, and I have a Facebook page, and I occasionally run little Facebook ads, I've found is somewhat helpful. So usually after I run the ads, my book sales go up a little bit.
Oh, see, that's a good news, because not many of my authors yet have talked about using Facebook ads, And I'm looking at it because I'm obviously on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Twitter and I have become friends, but it wasn't a very fun experience starting out because I'm what am I doing? I get Facebook, but I don't, But I've had now enough on my Facebook page that, I'm looking at running ads, and I'm like, I wonder if they're even worth it. If it boosts anything at all, but you say it has boosted your stuff.
I have. Yeah. Cause as long as you know who your audience is and target your audience. I mean, I'd like to think that my book would be read by anybody, but it's mostly airplane people that want to read it. So I can target my ads to, people who are interested in aviation topics on Facebook. So, and that's helped a lot. And that's also just helped me kind of with sales in general, that I do, there's always air shows going on and things like that, fly-ins and stuff. And there's a lot of, there's an organization called Experimental Aircraft Association, and they have chapters all over the place. So I go and I speak at chapters, and I take my book with me, and I almost always sell maybe 10, 12 books when I do that.
Good. Good results.
Yeah, it pays for my gas anyway. So
those are good results.
And then I just recently was at, I'm going to get this wrong. It's something like the Northwest Aviation Trade Show or something like that. And it's in Puyallup every year. And they just had that in February. And they gave me a booth there at a reduced rate. So I was able to sell like 50 books at that.
That's fantastic.
It was like thousands of people there.
That's good.
So it's kind of knowing your audience and knowing how to reach your audience is true, even if you are traditionally published. Authors today still have to do a lot of outreach work.
You can't be shy. So introverts, we just got to be out there.
And like I recently also just had a magazine article published on air racing with home-built aircraft, and published in Aviation History Magazine. And of course, I made sure that that they put in there the little blurb about me. That had a book out about home-built aircraft.
That's perfect. That's really smart. And what I'm hearing from you that I'm translating, because I'm working on historical fiction, is really knowing your audience. And if it's a niche audience, you have to go and find that niche and market to them.
Yes.
So awesome points and advice. What about support groups for you as an author? Because I did find you from a support group that, an association. That's how I tracked you down. So share with us what other support groups that you're involved with I usually will write those down and make sure that they're in the show notes for other authors to access as well. And talk a little bit about, you know, your involvement with support groups or associations and how, if it's beneficial for you as a writer or not.
Yeah, I found it to be beneficial. I'm not super active in any support groups right now. And some of that's just because my day job, I think, you know, I don't really have time to
have a day job.
And then I'm trying to write in the evening. I don't really have time.
I hear you.
So, but I, especially when I very first got started out, I found the support groups to be very useful. Because most of them have like conferences, they have, speakers at meetings, or they have webcasts or something like that. And again, I found all that material to be very, very helpful. The other thing that I did last summer, was it last summer? Not 17. It was the summer of 16. Mm-hmm. I went to a workshop. I signed up for a workshop and I went to that. It was a week long and it was specifically focused on nonfiction. And there was about, maybe about 12 or 13 of us in the
perfect number.
And it was just wonderful to be able to sit there for all. And it was a generative, some workshops you go to and you take material that you've already written.
Exactly. Yeah.
Feedback on it. This one, you were expected to generate material while you were there, which was a little bit scary. You know, every afternoon I'm going home, I'm like, I don't know if I can write this. You know, they give us some prompts and everything.
It's like boot camp school for writing.
Exactly. So yeah, but it was great. I mean, and again, just to be there with the whole author experience. And then we all kind of kept in touch with each other. Mm-hmm. And actually, and I'm maybe getting to another question you're going to ask. I don't know. But the thing that really helped me was one of the guys that was in the class is a published author. He has several books out, and he offered to introduce me to his agent. I have some ideas for future books, and I was actually writing some material at the workshop that is going to go into what I hope is going to become my next book. And so he email introduced me to his agent. I once I got my proposal together, I got back from the workshop, I finished putting the proposal together, and he introduced me to the agent, and the agent and I went back and forth a few times on the proposal, trying to, you know, make it more the way she wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. And then she took me on as a client.
Oh, congratulations. That's great.
Thank you. So
See, that's what that networking I'm finding is so incredibly important. And I'm being blessed just by meeting authors and doing the podcast. I already started this amazing network of people that I can, you know, call or say, hey, I need help that you just demonstrated an aspect of networking that if we don't get ourselves out there and put ourselves out and meet people or go to a workshop, you never know what your opportunity might be from that network.
Exactly.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. So I definitely encourage people, even if you're not much of a joiner, I encourage people to do these kinds of things. Cause that's really, you know, not only do you get great feedback on your work, you get lots of tips and just kind of tips in general. And like sometimes people will have like a session that they do on writing better dialogue, you know, or some, and that kind of stuff. So there's just, you know, there's just a wealth of experience out there, a wealth of information. And like you said, just knowing other people and just even knowing other people are going through the same struggles that you are.
Exactly. I have one friend that I'll message and, you know, if I know she's awake and I'm still up, which is rare because I get up really early. That's when I write. I'm an early bird. I don't typically stay up late because I'm exhausted, but I know that she might be up and I'll message her, hey, how you doing? How's your day? I'm doing this, you know, so it's nice to know there's other people out there that are going through this journey with you, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fantastic. Okay. So we have a couple more questions and I think it's going to lead back to what you were hinting with your agent. So, first off, what has been your inspiration and what keeps you going and motivated to be, continuing this journey of writing?
I think just wanting to get people's stories out there. The stories that I write, because of my military background, they tend to have a military component to them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's been so many books written about military, doing these really dramatic, rescues and all that kind of stuff. And I think there's a lot more stories out there to be told, though, that are that are more, that are quieter stories. I don't know the right way to say this.
No, you know, I get it.
There's a lot of really interesting things that people have done. Uh-huh. And I meet people all the time and I go, oh my gosh, I had never, you know, heard of that. And there's a lot of forgotten stories out there too. Things that are dramatic, but people have just forgotten about them. Things that happened in Vietnam or right mm-hmm. around the end of mm-hmm. Vietnam. And that's kind of the era I'm mostly interested in because those vets are still alive and still lucid exactly. for the most part, you know? And so, mm-hmm. And a lot of their stories have been forgotten. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. so I'm trying to, I really want to try to capture a lot of that and Cold War stories too, because that's mm-hmm. another part that people have forgotten that, you know, during the Cold War, even though we weren't in a shooting war, you know, people died because yeah. of all the training that we did. And, mm-hmm. and there, we were very serious about, you know, taking care of business, even though there wasn't live shooting going on. And even Korea, you know, I think a lot of people have kind of forgotten that we've been in Korea since 1950. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And what's interesting is that it's parts of history that the farther we get away from it, it's more likely those stories will not exist.
Because exactly.
individuals yeah. that have that firsthand account may be mm-hmm. passing.
Exactly.
Or not able to share any longer the full stories.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what I'm trying to do. That's what inspires me is all these people's stories and try to capture them and put them together in a narrative form that can not just tell people about their stories, but can entertain them and, you know, and keep those stories alive. So that's what I really care about.
I love it. Well, I think it's fabulous and exciting, and I look forward to all your work that you have. I find it just amazing. We have a lot of people that have done, like you said, quiet journeys in the military, mm-hmm. and they would never go out and share their stories, but I think we need to hear it. We need to know, you know, the process of what they've gone through and their experiences. So the last question before we get ready for your reading is, and I think you... Wait, did you touch on this a little bit about your future. So what is your future works and what, you know, what your process is going through in the future? So what can listeners be looking forward to? And you did touch on it a little bit with maybe
probably more books about military topics. The one that I'm working on right now, well, it's not a book yet, but it's still project, but it's about a Navy pilot who ejected. He was shot down over Vietnam. He was hit over North Vietnam. He ejected and he wound up landing just barely in the water off the coast of North Vietnam, and this rather dramatic rescue ensues. And so it's not just about that. I mean, that's probably about, you know, 20 minutes, you know, you know, it's about the whole process that people go through to become a Navy pilot in the first place. And all of the things that people went through, even though they weren't trained to rescue him, the things that they did on the fly, and this whole idea that the U.S. military never leaves anybody behind. You know, there's mm-hmm. like almost this obsession with don't leave somebody behind and mm-hmm. rescue people, or even if you don't rescue them, you keep trying to rescue them. If you, mm-hmm. you know, if they unfortunately do die, you still try to recover their remains mm-hmm. so the family can have some closure. So the whole book is kind of all about, you know, about that aspect, about combat search and rescue and why we do that and why that's important to not just the military, but to the United States in general. So that's that one. And then I just have other ideas about various, again, military topics, mostly aircraft related.
Oh, they're fabulous.
Because I'm mostly into, you know, aviation kinds of things. So I have some ideas from some other books as well, though, that are aviation related, but not military. So, but I think you'll kind of see that theme in all of my books, military aviation.
They tell us to write what we love and write what we know, because we're going to actually do our best writing. So yes. I think it's fabulous that you're doing that. I love the idea of that story, and I can't wait to hear about it coming out. We'll have you back on the podcast after that.
Yeah.
We won't have to talk about everything else. We can just tell about the story.
right. So yeah, the current story.
So speaking of that, listeners have been patiently waiting to hear you read. So why don't you set up for us what you're going to read, kind of give us some background so that we can picture what you're reading for us.
Okay. So again, my book, The Propeller Under the Bed, it's got two stories in it. Like I said, it's kind of my dad's story of designing this airplane and then using it to set a world record and kind of the 50-year process to do that. And then the other part of the story is the history of home-built aircraft. The two readings that I'm going to do today don't really have anything to do with the home-built aircraft side of it. I just wanted to, you know, I was trying to think of, you know, what are some of my favorite scenes in the book? And so I decided to pull out the two of the scenes that I like the best. So, and one of them is centered around my dad, and the other one is centered around my mom. And
oh, fantastic.
And so the first scene is my first, is the first reading is my dad's first flight in an airplane when he was 8 years old. And so this was in 1936, remember. So it's not like, you know, first flight today, you know, everybody flies in airplanes nowadays.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
But in 1936, flying in an airplane was a big deal. Yeah. So just kind of keep that in mind, you know, as I go through the reading. And then the second one is a scene that takes place when my dad was a fighter pilot at Foster Air Force Base in Texas. And so this would have been in 1956. And they had just transitioned to a new airplane called the F-100. It was a very dangerous airplane to fly, and lots of pilots were getting killed. Mm-hmm. And when a military member dies, there's a whole process that you're supposed to go through where the person's commander, and they get the chaplain, and it's very formal process, and they all put on their, you know, their dress blues, and they mm-hmm. go to the door, and they mm-hmm. sit down with the family, you know, and everything. And so, so the family's not supposed to know ahead of time that, you know, that the person has died. There's this process. So this kind of centers around, you'll see what happens.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Well, I just kind of wanted to set that up.
No, it's perfect. I appreciate that. I'm sure the listeners do too. So,
okay.
So I will be quiet.
Okay. So here's the first reading. My father's first flight occurred at the annual Fall Frolic Festival in Mount Horeb. Two barnstormers arrived in airplanes with wingspans the length of small houses, one appropriating the golf course next to the festival, while the other used an adjoining farmer's field. The pilots offered rides for $1 per person, and as soon as 8-year-old Arnold spotted the airplanes, he pleaded with Emil for a ride. Emil's his father. $1 was an exorbitant amount of money during the Great Depression, especially for a farmer, but Emil didn't need much convincing. He, too, wanted to indulge in his first flight. On spying Arnold's 3-year-old brother, Frank, the pilot proclaimed, "The little guy can go, too." So father and sons piled together into the emerald and orange airplane. Arnold sat up front while Emil, holding Frank, crammed himself into the back seat along with the fourth passenger. Arnold could hardly believe his good fortune as he watched the pilot push and pull an assortment of mysterious levers and knobs to make the airplane move. At the end of the field, the radial engine roared to life and the plane accelerated along the sod, bouncing as it picked up speed until suddenly they weren't bouncing and Arnold realized they were in the air. He watched in awe as the ground receded, marveling at the houses that from 1,000 feet looked like they could fit in his hand. The dials and equipment looked terribly complicated, and the airplane was noisy and reeked of oil and gasoline, but Arnold soaked it all up. The smells, the vibrations that pulsed through his body, and the pilot's cool confidence. The flight lasted only 15 minutes, but it hooked Arnold forever. The experience made him like a stranded shipwreck survivor gulping a cup of ocean water. It only made him thirst for the thing he could not have. And he didn't want to be just a passenger. He wanted to be a pilot, to fly the airplane himself, free to go anywhere and do anything. So. Okay, the second reading is the one from Foster Air Force Base. So. In January, the Foster wives went on high alert when two F-100 pilots died in landing accidents as Arnold and his unit flew across the country for an exercise. Everyone else arrived safely at Wendover Air Force Base, Utah, but the carnage wasn't over yet. One afternoon, many of the deployed pilots assembled near the end of the runway to watch a landing by one of the colonels with a reputation for scraping the tail of his airplane on the runway. As the aviators waited for the potential tail scrape entertainment, a flight of four F-100s departed for the gunnery range. Shortly after taking off, the pilot leading the departing flight radioed, "I've got a fire warning light." Seeing smoke trailing from the stricken aircraft's engine in a bright red spot on the side of the fuselage, one of the wingmen called out, "Eject, eject, eject." The lead pilot thought he could make it back to the airfield, and he turned around. Just short of the runway, he reported, "The controls have frozen." The F-100 slammed into the ground, and the rear half of the jet exploded in a fireball. The cockpit skidded forward, stopping just short of the runway, bringing hope to those on the ground that the pilot had survived. Back at Foster, phones began ringing. As my mother played with my sister and contemplated what to do over the weekend with Arnold gone in Utah, someone knocked on the apartment door. Colleen wasn't surprised to see one of the squadron wives, since they often dropped in on each other uninvited. "Can I come in for a minute? I have something to tell you." Once inside, the other wife said, "We need to sit down." Her curiosity piqued, Colleen led her to the dining room table. "I wanted to tell you this so you'll be prepared. There's been an accident in Utah." Colleen's head started spinning, but she didn't say anything. "I heard it was one of the guys who had the F-104 ground school." "That's six guys," said Colleen, "but only two of them are in Utah, Arnold and John Hungerford." Colleen showed the other woman out and tried to comprehend what might have happened. If Arnold had crashed, he must have messed up, but she didn't think he would have messed up. On the other hand, he wasn't perfect. He had almost crashed on his first takeoff in the F-100, and he had blown tires on landings. And even if he hadn't made a mistake, something else could have happened to the airplane he was flying. What about Elton Bocage, who had been killed flying the F-86? He hadn't done anything wrong. But if Arnold was dead, why wasn't someone from the base here to tell her? When Bocage had died, they hadn't been able to find his wife right away, but she had been out shopping or something. Colleen had been in the apartment all day. But why hadn't he called to say he was okay? At first, Colleen's horror grew with each passing minute. But as the minutes turned into an hour, and then two, and then three, she realized that perhaps Arnold wasn't dead or dying after all. Surely someone would have arrived by now. She called no one. What could she say without letting on that she knew something? And if Arnold were alive, her joy meant sorrow for someone else. About 8 o'clock, the phone rang, and as she heard Arnold's voice, anger replaced relief. "Why did you wait so long to call me?" Arnold was speechless, having no idea she had heard about the accident. He told Colleen he had been strapped into another F-100 waiting to taxi for takeoff when the accident happened. After the crash, the senior officer at Wendover had canceled all flying for the rest of the day, and Arnold had shut down his F-100 and joined the other pilots as they consoled each other.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Gives us such a pointed picture of what your mother had to go through.
Yeah, that was a story I always remembered so much from my childhood. And she was actually pregnant with me at the time.
Oh, goodness.
And I don't think she even knew that yet. I think it was like maybe a few weeks later that she found out. Yeah.
So absolutely wonderful. So thank you so much for being on the podcast. Listeners, if you love this story and the theme that Eileen has in the book, find her on her website, buy the book, write her a review. And we'll definitely have you back on when your next book is published. You can talk about that.
Thanks. I really appreciate it. I've really enjoyed talking with you. So.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. We hoped you loved hearing from the author as much as we did. If you did enjoy the author, make sure you find them on social media. Buy their book and write a review. Are you a published author and would like to be featured on the podcast? Visit us at our website to learn more. You can help support the production of this podcast by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Share the podcast with your friends. And most importantly, become a supporter. Supporters receive monthly bonus podcasts and a newsletter filled with tips from our authors. To find out more how to become a supporter, visit our website. And finally, I hope you always remember to enjoy the journey. Until next week, this is Vicki J. Carter saying goodbye.